She looked at me and she says, "We have to do this or they're going to do it." And she's like, "I'm calling CPS." I'm like, "No, you're not." She's like, "I'm already dialing." So she calls CPS on herself. I mean, they were there within 10 minutes after we got off the phone. And I'm like, this is way too fast. When we told him, or she told him, "All right, you're going to have to go live with some people right now." And he's like, "Why?" "Because me and mommy have to go to the hospital because we're sick." He's like, "Are you guys going to come back for me?" And
what's going on, guys? Wise Media Studios back with another episode here. Today, we've got a couple of guests in the studio. We've got two guests from Yakima Recovery Events. We're going to be talking to Floyd and Philip here in a second. But first, we've got this message from one of our awesome sponsors. We'll be right back. Today's Yakima Spotlight Thursday is brought to you by the Recreation Center, which is conveniently located downtown, 200 South Front Street, Yakima. The Recreation Center, your plug-and-play venue for private or public events of all types, sport court rentals, and more. Also, home for Conquer Athletics, top producer of grit in Central Washington's premier Spartan DECA founding affiliate. Contact them today on Facebook at Conquer Athletics or on Instagram at The Recreation Center. All right, and we're back. So, Floyd, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
And Philip, how are you doing?
I'm blessed. I'm doing good today.
Philip, I can only think of South Park. So you guys, you got your own things going on, individual recovery in general, and you also have a nonprofit Yakima Recovery Events that you kind of spearhead to some extent, correct?
Correct.
Okay. So both of you are active in recovery. You've got some time under your belt, 26 months, and you're going on 3 months, 71 days in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about, I know you and I spoke briefly last week, and we've done some segments, Streets of Yakima, Homeless and Addicted, where we've talked to people that are more in active addiction. We haven't really had a chance to speak to anybody in active recovery. So let's hear a little bit from you first, Floyd, about your background, your substance abuse, kind of how you segued into recovery and what that looks like for you today.
All right. Probably about four years ago, me and my significant other just had our son. She was working at a dealership. She ended up doing cocaine, and I got it for her since I had all the connects here in Yakima. And cocaine was one of my drugs I used to like at the bar after drinking and all that. But she didn't want me to do it, so she introduced me to methamphetamines, and I fell in love. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I fell in love. It felt like I was just drinking energy drinks. She was like, "You're going to enjoy it for the first year, but after that, we're going to lose everything." You know, and I'm like, "Yeah, whatever. Sure. You know, we're doing great. I don't see it happening." I mean, she was correct. A year later, we were getting evicted from our apartment with our two children. We end up moving to my mom's property on the east side of Yakima. Me and her were living in the car. Our kids were staying inside at my sister's house. Until it came to the point where we couldn't stay there no more, so we moved into a trap house. We walked in, kicked everybody out that was big-time dope heads, even though we were the biggest dope heads, but we couldn't see it in ourselves. That lasted for about 2 years, and then we got 86 from the property by the sheriffs. We gave our daughter to her grandparents.
So your daughter was living with you guys in the trap house at this point?
Correct.
And how old was your daughter at this time?
She was in first grade.
Okay, so six.
Yes,
okay.
Six, 7. And our son was 3.
Okay. Was there like running water and stuff?
Yeah, we had running water. We had electricity. We had, you know, it was a normal running house. It was just on a foreclosure house.
Right. You guys were kind of squatting.
Correct, okay. Correct. Her friend at that time was actually buying the house, and the owner never paid the payments. Mm. So 2 years later, out of nowhere, the sheriff showed up and was like, "This house is foreclosed. You have to move out." So we end up giving our daughter to her grandparents. She moved to Arizona. but I wasn't going to let my son go nowhere. So he came with us and he lived with us on the streets for the, like, we put him in different houses, but he was just, he was like Dennis the Menace times two. Like, nobody could control him. Fast forward a little bit, at the end, we were living in our minivan again at the end of Race Street. I thought it would be a smart idea, which to this day, I still kind of think it is. If we park in apartment plexes, nobody will bother us because there's so many big apartment plexes down there. And it worked. You know, cops never bugged us, nothing like that, because I was ashamed of who we were. You know what I mean? I didn't want nobody to find us, nothing like that. It came to one day, we were at Sportsman's Park. That's where we used to take showers at, was Sportsman's, the only place we could take showers. And she looked at me and she says, we have to do this or they're going to do it. And I didn't understand what she was saying. I was smoking right then and there. I'm like, what are you talking about? So we drove over to the dog pound and she's like, I'm calling CPS. I'm like, no, you're not. She's like, I'm already dialing. So she called CPS on ourselves. We put our son in temporary foster care because we could not take care of him. Like, we didn't want him living with us in the van no more. So that gave us 60 days. Step back a little bit before that, she was trying to get into treatment. She knew because, you know, she had 7 years at one time in recovery, but she relapsed because of her work. So she knew what she had to do. And I've never been in recovery in my life. This is the first time I've ever done it. So she was trying to call treatment facilities to get in, but that was during COVID. So nobody was taking anybody. So we put him in CPS custody. We had 60 days. They gave us resources to go to. We went to one resource over here on Walnut across the street from the police station. They told me they could get us done in 14 days. And I said, that's not going to work. I have 60 days. So I went down here to a treatment facility on 2nd and Lincoln on a Friday night. They were like, we get you in on Monday morning. A week later, she gets shipped out to detox. I get shipped out to detox a week after her.
And who paid? And the state paid for this?
Yeah, state insurance paid for it.
Okay.
And at that time, we didn't even have state insurance. They put us on state insurance. They're like, we'll take care of it. Don't worry. You know, you guys are homeless. You guys are in active addiction. There's programs out here to get you off of the streets. I'm like, okay, my whole thing, I just wanted my son back. That's it. My daughter, she is safe. She's with the grandparents. So, you know, but my son's in a foster care. I don't want him in there.
And in the foster care, it was 60 days, right?
Correct.
What happens if you don't have your shit together after 60 days? Does it become permanent foster care?
Then we go back. Well, we have to go back to court in 60 days. And the judge gets to look at what we've been doing in them 60 days. Mm-hmm. If it could be extend out to 90 days. And then if we would have went past 90 days, it could end up where they would just take custody of him.
And then once he goes into a permanent type of a situation, you don't even know where he's at that point.
Correct. We didn't know where he was at all. Anyways, they will never tell us where he was.
Oh, man. What does that feel like as a parent? You know, obviously you're battling with addiction, but at the same time, you're like, there's got to be the thought playing in your head, I might lose my kid for good.
That I'm worthless. Like, I'm just like my parents. Because I was in CPS custody when I was a little kid. Like, I've always told myself I'll do better for my kids, you know what I mean? But I allowed a drug to overpower me. And it completely did. Like, I lived, died for that drug 24/7 to make sure I had it. So we went into treatment. I only lasted 3 days in treatment. They shipped me out of town. They put me in Vancouver, Washington. I lasted 3 days and I walked out.
What was it that you couldn't do? What was the hard part? Structure, not having the drug?
Anxiety, not able to see my son because we had they told me like, all right, you get up there, we'll bring him up to you in a week and you get to see him every week you're there because of the plan that we had through CPS. But that treatment facility wouldn't let nobody in because of COVID. So that, the anxiety and just feeling like I was locked in a cage. You know what I mean? Like, it was basically my disease telling me that you don't need to be here. So what I did, I walked out. Probably one of the worst decisions I've ever done in my life. I could have lost my son because I walked out.
When you walked out, did you go back to using drugs?
No. That's the funniest thing. A lot of people ask me that. So what I did was, I have a buddy that lives in Vancouver. He's a military vet. And I got a hold of him and I was like, I'm sorry, bro, I let you down. Cause that's why I felt like I did. Like, you didn't let me down. Just continue doing what you're doing. He put me on a train. I went to Pasco and my drug dealer picked me up in Pasco. And on the way back, they were smoking the whole way there. They were doing fentanyl, smoking meth all the way. And they kept saying, hey, do you want some? I'm like, no, my head was out the window the whole time. I'm like, no. Got to Yakima around 11:30 at night. Slept in my minivan that night. Woke up at 7 and I went down to Barth Clinic. That's the place that shipped me out to treatment. I walk in and I'm like, I messed up. They're like, yes, you did. But we'll figure this out together.
If you would have used on that drive and walked into Barth Clinic high, would it have been indifferent? Would they still have taken you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they would have still took me, but it would have looked bad on my CPS record. You know what I mean?
Definitely go back in front of the judge. They wouldn't have given you any help.
Yeah, and we haven't even went in front of the judge
yet. But I mean, when you did go back in front of the judge, that would have been probably notated.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. And the UA would have been notated. So they threw me, they did another assessment and they threw me an IOP, which is intensive outpatient. And then they were like, you got to go live at Camp Hope. And I'm like, oh, I'm cool. I'll live in my minivan. They're like, you can't live in your minivan no more. You have to go live at Camp Hope, which is a homeless shelter that we have here. And I went there and I fell in love with Camp Hope. It reminded me of the TV show MASH. Everybody laughs when I say it, but it really did. I felt like I was in the TV show MASH.
Me and Francis did a tour there. It does kind of look like, you ever watch MASH, Francis?
Yeah.
It does have a MASH feel. It's got like the barracks kind of.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It was like cool, you know? And I was like, and I would walk from there to Barth every day at 6 o'clock at night to go to my classes. I remember my first class I went to, the counselor asked me, he's like, what are you here for? And I'm like, I'm here to get my son back. He's like, okay. I'm like, well, that's not the right answer. He's like, you're not going to make it. I'm like, yeah, I am. I'm going to get my kid back. He's like, but you won't stay clean. And I'm like, and I didn't understand what it was. A couple days later, I talked to the lady that put me in treatment and she's like, what are you doing this for again? I'm like, I'm doing this to get my son back. And they're like, you're going to relapse. I'm like, how do you figure that? And she's like, from personal experience, you will. Because if you're not doing this for yourself, then I don't know why you're doing this for. Because let's say that your son gets mad at you one day and says, I liked you better when you were high. That's going to give you have the reservation. Like, well, fine, I'm going to be high because you like me better like that. And I think that was the smartest thing somebody's ever told me in my whole entire life. Because I took that to heart and I started doing this for myself. So my significant other comes out of treatment.
So she stayed in treatment.
Yeah, she stayed. She did her 28 days in Vancouver. And then she got transferred over here to a women's treatment for our son. She comes out. I think we're like at 30 days right at that time. We have 60 days to do this all. She joins IOP. We do IOP together. And she's like, have you been to a meeting? I'm like, yeah, I go to one every day at 6 o'clock. And she's like, that's class. That's not a meeting. And I didn't understand what she was saying, you know, because I'm new to all this. She's like, we have to go to a 12-step program. We have to have a meeting at least 5 times a week. That's what the treatment facility requires.
And your girl was telling you this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So we went to a place called Serenity Hall on Summit View. And that's when I walked into my first 12-step program. And when I walked in, I wasn't an addict. I could quit whenever I wanted. So jump forward a little bit. It's a 45-day mark. We get our phone call with the CPS caseworker, her boss, the lady that's watching our son, and the judge, I think it was. And they had the conversation with us. And in my head, what I heard was, we're not getting our son back. So I get mad. I had two choices. I could turn around, walk to my dealer, and just get high again, because I'm not going to get him back no matter what. Or I could go into this 12-step meeting and just talk about it. I decided to go in 12-step meeting, telling them like, hey, I want to go get C4. I want to blow this building up if I don't get my son back, everything like that. And after the meeting, my significant other, she tells me, she's like, you heard this conversation totally wrong. She's like, we're getting our son back. She's like, I got to call him right now. And she called, and by our higher powers of will, the next day he gets dropped off to us. because at this time we're already in transitional housing.
I was going to ask, where were you living?
Yeah. We were living in a transitional housing right there off of Summitview. And he came to us. She dropped him off. And it was probably the hardest thing in the world to hear him say, I don't want to be here. I want to go back to the lady that was taking care of him. And I'm like, why? You're with your mom and dad, you know, like this and that. So I had to go to a 12-step program.
Did he give you a reason as why he wanted to go back? Did he explain it?
He was comfortable there.
He had structure.
He had a routine that he did every day. It was just a normal living for him. So I went and I talked to a couple people in the 12-step meeting I was attending. And there was an old timer there. He has like 28 years or something. And I'm like, hey, this is how I'm feeling right now. Like, you know, my son doesn't want to be with this. He's like, yeah, he doesn't. And I'm like, what do you mean by that? He's like, he doesn't know who you guys are. He's using you guys fighting, beating each other up, getting high, pushing him away, telling him to go somewhere else because you're getting high the whole time. And now he comes back to you guys and you guys are loving, caring. You want to spend time with him. You know what I mean? He's like, who are these two people? I don't know who they are.
He probably didn't trust it.
Yeah, and he didn't trust it. It took a little bit. Probably 3 months or so.
It's like bringing in a broken puppy to your house that's been beaten and you show it love at first, bite your hand a few times until it knows that it gets into a routine.
Yes, correct. So it took a couple months and he started getting used to it, you know. About a year later, around 50 days, we have a final interview with the whole CPS caseworker, the judge and all that. And they were like, how do you want to go about this to finish it? Because we had to go to court. And the judge was like, I don't know how to do this case. And I'm like, what do you mean by that, ma'am? Because I'm talking totally different than when I first talked When I first talked to him, I was getting high the whole time. Mm-hmm. This time, my head was straight. I was like, what's going on, this and that. And she's like, I don't know how to end this case. She's like, you guys have done everything we required you do plus more. We've never had that. Like, you guys did it in 45 days. Like, this is the fastest we've ever had somebody get their kid back in this program of CPS, the program that we're a part of, temporary foster care. They're like, you went above and beyond that what you needed to do. They're like, so we're going to close the case. You'll get paperwork in a week. Everything's done. You guys, you know, we're out of the way. So we got him back full custody and all that. Put him in kindergarten. I first put him in daycare. That was weird. Like, now I'm taking him to daycare at 7:30 in the morning, you know?
Holy fuck, I'm a real adult.
Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean? Because before I was like, you stay awake as long as you want. I don't sleep whenever you want. It doesn't matter to me.
Eat what you want.
Yeah, whatever. Do whatever you want. You know what I mean? And now, you know, he's on a routine and all that.
How did he do initially in daycare with other kids? Was he, because originally said, like, Dennis Menace times three. Was he still, that's a lot of shit for a kid to go through. It's a lot of trauma that kid experienced. Did it come out in school at all?
Well, when he was in temporary foster care, they put him in daycare.
Okay.
So I don't know how it went over there because we don't really get to hear what happens over there. But when he came with us and we put him in, it was a little rocky, you know, like he was standoffish of kids or if, you know, he would hurt them, like hit them or something like that. But that was only like a couple weeks. After that, it was just like, he would rather be at school.
He became
like,
a kid.
Yeah, he's like, can I go to school now? I'm like, you mean daycare? He's like, it's school, Dad, it's school. So it was great. And then kindergarten came around and I was able to be a parent and take him to his orientation. Yeah, he was excited. You know, he was excited. So that all happened. And I just got more and more into this 12-step program. I started taking the suggestions. I started doing that, started living that program to the best of my ability, and we end up getting a year clean. And we moved into a clean and sober living, which is called Next Step Housing. It's a apartment. It's like an apartment plex here in Yakima. They have like five properties, but you have to have a year clean, and it's a clean and sober living.
And you have to pay for it?
Yes, we pay for it.
Is it like weekly rent, monthly rent?
It's monthly rent.
Okay.
It's monthly rent. So
what's, can I ask, like, for people out there looking, because obviously there's a lot of people struggling, what does it roughly cost a month?
It all depends on the person.
Okay.
You know, because we came in with a family of four. So, and then we got Section 8 because she was a part of a different program. They put her on Section 8. You know, there's a lot of programs out there that will help pay your rent. And we didn't understand none of this when we were out there using. When we were homeless, we thought there was nobody that cared about us. You know, we were just pushed under the rug and like, yep, push them under the rug, let them be. Nobody cares about us. But there's actually a lot of programs here in the Valley that will help you get out of your active addiction.
Did your son ever ask, like, you know, are you going to send me away again? Or why did I leave? Did he have any questions?
He hasn't asked questions since he's been back. But when we did, when CPS pulled up, they pulled up like a NASCAR pit stop. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were there within 10 minutes after we got off the phone. And I'm like, this is way too fast. When we told him, or she told him, all right, you're going to have to go live with some people right now. And he's like, why? Because me and mommy have to go to the hospital because we're sick. He's like, are you guys going to come back for me? And we're like, we will. We'll be back for you no matter what. We're coming to get you. And that's basically the last conversation we had with him. But before he even left the parking lot, I picked up the pipe. You know what I mean? That's how powerful my disease is. Like, you just lost your son and you want to pick up a pipe and smoke. That's what I'm used to doing. Yeah, that was the last thing we told him, that we will be back for you. We just have to go to the hospital. And now he knows, like, he kind of gets it. Like, he knows we go to a meeting every day. He's like, if you guys don't go to the meeting, you're going to have to go back to the hospital. You know what I mean? And older that he gets, we'll get more in depth with him, but he's only 6 right now. Like, that's a lot on him.
So there definitely is some level of associated trauma.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he has PTSD from it.
Does he go into counseling or through the children's services? Do they make sure he's seeing somebody to check on his, you know, because you look at where a lot of addicts come from, and it could come from stuff like this if it's not dealt with.
When we first got into the whole recovery process, CPS did put us with a child program that they offer, and we put him through like a 3-month class with them, a behavioral,
like a cognitive behavior therapy program. Like,
you know, don't whip him, say no, or you know, he like taught us totally different. Because when I grew up, if I did something wrong, my grandma was grabbing a switch off the tree.
But your grandma probably wasn't, when she didn't put the switch down and pick up a meth pipe.
No, she didn't, you know.
So that had a lot.
Yeah. Right? But what she did, she just picked up a bingo dauber because she was addicted to bingo.
Do they have to? What would that even be called? Like, they got him for gambling.
It's a gamble. It's gambling.
Oh, GA.
She was a gamboholic. You know, but like, that's how we were raised. I'm pretty sure you were raised the same way, guinea whipped and all that.
Yeah.
When we went into this program, it was like, you no longer touch your kid. You go to the corner and sit there and all that. That was really hard to do, but it did help us out as a family to find a different way. Yeah. And to this day, I still haven't whipped him, even though there's a lot of times I want to.
Right.
I just go to your room, shut the door, and sit in there and cry till you're done. You know.
Well, Floyd, thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
It's impactful. Almost brought me to tears.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be hard for a lot of people out there watching, because I don't know what the stats are, but I imagine more people don't make it out of this than do, just because it's a very powerful drug, as you so elegantly stated. So we're going to come back in a few minutes, and I want to hear about, you know, some of the lifestyle that you were into before this. Philip. Oh, real, what's typically the amount of time that, you know, what's the threshold before, is it 30 days? Once you make 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, where's the average, that the point of no return? Like, once you cross this line, you've got a better chance of making it. Is there a stat for that?
I don't know if there's really a stat for it, because I've seen people come in and come and go.
Right.
You know what I mean? With tons of clean time.
Because you've got 26 months.
Correct.
So you've got over 2 years.
Correct.
And Philip, you're quite
almost 3 months.
Almost 3 months. So you're are you still thinking about addiction? Do you still have like triggers? And what was your drug of choice?
My drug of choice was alcohol and cocaine. I do have triggers. I just like learn to say no to drugs every day, like just for the day. It's helped me. But like, as far as like seeing people, you do see them come and go. You'll see a new crowd, I guess you say, in the meetings. And next week you won't see the same people and you'll see a whole new crowd. And then the week after you'll see another crowd. Like, it changes week to week.
And how old are you?
Me, I'm 32.
32. And have you tried to stop it in the past?
Yes, I have. I'm from Phoenix, Arizona, and the crowd I was hanging out with them, I just can never get clean. And then I had to move back here and live with my aunt and just go to treatment in order to like, you have to change everything about yourself, like people you hung out with, places and things. And now I'm able to stay clean.
What's the longest you've been clean before this?
I would say 3 months.
3 months.
So I'm almost back at it.
And I guess that's what I was trying to get to before. Does that make, because you know you did it before for 3 months and then something happened, you went back.
Yeah.
Is that a fear in the back of your head? Like,
yes.
I want to be clean, but fuck, I know it's possible for me to make a mistake.
Yes.
So do you talk about, is he your sponsor or big brother or just?
He's someone I look up to and okay. I see him in meetings every day.
Okay. And that's how you found out about this?
Yes.
So how do you focus on, you know, obviously you can't predict what the outcome of the future is going to be, but you know you don't want to go back to that life. How do you prepare yourself that I'm about to hit the amount of time that I hit before? You like, are you going to feel like you're going to want to celebrate it 3 months kind of a thing?
I'm honestly not really trying to celebrate it. I'm just celebrating today and like keep myself busy as I can throughout the day. And then that means go to meetings. And then sometimes I get to hang out with my nieces and nephews. I'll do that. But as far as being in my own head, that's where the trouble comes in. Once you get too much free time, then the triggers, they call it, come sit in, and then you just had too much alone time.
But my drug of choice was cocaine as well, especially when I was drinking, because it would, you know, in the moment, like, oh, it's going to sober me up. You find all kinds of excuses.
Yeah, you could drink more.
Yeah.
And, you know, Floyd, you said, you know, you got to bring your child to kindergarten. You know, you're up at 7 in the morning. One of my favorite parts of the day is like morning time, sunrises. But when I was in active addiction as a cocaine user, seeing the sunshine after like not sleeping for 2 days is not the same thing as like waking up at 5:30 in the morning and enjoying a sunrise. It's a different kind of a sunrise.
Yeah.
How long have you been here in Yakima?
I've been here the 16th of December. I moved here. The January 12th was my clean date.
Okay.
That was the last time I used.
Been here a few months. And your family, do you have a supportive family?
Yes, I do. I'm back with my aunt now. And then my sister lives here. I moved away from here when I was 9. And now I'm back and she's in recovery too. She has 3 years. She celebrated 3 years on the 10th.
Well, congratulations to her. So what do you do on, like, what's your day to day like now? Are you working? So
I go to IOP classes, just like what Floyd was talking about. Go to classes, get to learn how to work the program, the steps. I just finished my first step packet. I'm not really doing the first step yet with the program, but that just, it's a process. But like, I got idea of how to do it. And then I go to meetings right after that, and I just keep myself busy, pretty much just try to stay out the streets.
Okay. What's the biggest struggle for you right now? Like
the beer everywhere. Like anywhere you go, you see beer. And then, you know, I say it's more over here. It's more free willing to get. Like they don't even lock it up. It's like.
Oh, you mean like when you go into grocery stores and stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Walgreens, it will have it right there by the door. Like you could run out with that. But it's just. Me, what I've learned is like, just don't go into the stores. Like, try to stay away from them as much as possible. Stay out of bars, obviously.
And probably, like, if your friends that drink alcohol, you're not going to go to a bar with them because, you know, hearing his story about walking out of a fucking inpatient place and getting into a car with a bunch of meth heads and didn't use, that's, you know, that's,
it's hard.
That's tough. Like not a lot of people. I can't even say you put me into a car right now with a bunch of guys doing cocaine. I don't know where, what I'd be like. Ugh.
See, that's the big thing to me is like, I had to move. I had to make that move, change my people. Now I just have a bunch of friends that are in the, you know, in the program working the steps. So as long as you're working the steps, I allow you around me, but I don't tend to kick it with anybody that's in active addiction because it's only going to set me up for failure. So I just, you know, put my like circle now is just everybody that goes to meeting, everybody that's in the program.
Is it inspiring when you go to these programs and you'll see people like Floyd that, you know, he's coming up on just over 2 years, and then you'll see guys that have got like 5 years, and like how he said there was a guy with like 28 years and you're brand new into it, but you know at some point they were exactly where you are.
Yes.
Does that give you hope that like, man, if they
can do it,
I can do it?
Yes. Every day, because we just got back from this program. There was a convention over in Sela, and it changed my whole life. I got a spiritual awakening. It just, because there's people in there that got 54 years or 47 years, the highest amount. And I was like, dang, like, but it all starts with just for the day. Like one day at a time, you can't future trip and think like, oh, it's going to happen sometime. If you're not willing to put the work in, then you're not. You can't recover.
That's where our motto comes from here. I did some time federal prison. I did a drug program called RDAP, which is very similar to like a lot of stuff you're doing. And our motto there was one day at a time, people up and people, community is method, you know, because of course we all want to jump forward and say, I want to be at this place in 10 years, but man, you gotta be at this place tomorrow before you get there. What was your rock bottom? Like what happened to you that, you know, because obviously you don't just go, you know what, I think I've had enough, or maybe that was it for you, but what happened back home? Was there any criminal activity? Did you get locked up at all? Like, tell us a little bit about the backstory.
No, I didn't get locked up. I got real addicted to PCP, SHRM, and it's just one of those drugs that, like, it had to be there. I had to get it, And it cost me my job, which then cost me my house. So then I was living out of my homie's Jeep, and you know, when you're sitting back in the Jeep, you know, where did my life go? What am I doing? This ain't for me. The only option I had left was, you know, pretty much beg for my aunt to, like, you know what, I could come back. And she accepted me to come back and was like, hey, only way you're going to come back is you get clean and sober. I'm not going to play with none of the bullshit. And I did. I voluntarily, you know, I had no illegal issues or nothing like that, but I voluntarily put my own time into going to treatment center, went to JOTC, learned the process. And then, you know, in that program, learned rock bottom is just death. Like, you could always dig a little bit deeper. So I learned that, like, it's good to start now rather than wait till later when you have nothing left. Because the last thing I had to lose was my life.
You had no kids or anything?
No, I don't.
Okay. Which I imagine makes it a little bit easy, because hearing that story about telling your, what he had to tell his son as, like you said, 10 minutes later, they're there. It's not even like he had time to like really digest what you just told him. It's like you're going to live somebody and then they're here, strangers yanking you into a car. That's heartbreaking to hear that. And I'm sure like Francis, or you're listening, who's got little kids, like, could you imagine telling that to your daughter?
It really is hard for me to hear that. It'd be hard to do.
What was the moment? I'll ask this question's to you too, so I'll ask you first. What was the moment? Can you sit back and remember at what moment you realized, when you were honest with yourself, that you're like, I'm an addict? Like, do you know when that was?
When I actually got to JOTC, and like, because in my head I was like, I'm just here and I'm an alcoholic, you know. And then to thinking about it, I was like, I don't really do drugs. And then yeah, I do. You know, it's like you got to sit down and you have that conversation with yourself and be honest. You're like, yeah, I did do this. I did steal. I did cheat. I did, you know, abuse it and got away with it. And now it's like you didn't really get away with nothing. You got tired of being sick and tired.
And this was when and where?
At JOTC.
That's in Yakima?
Yeah, it's in, I think, Bermuda.
Uana.
That's here in Washington?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm kind of new.
It's in the Lower Valley.
Okay. So this was recently?
Yeah, recently, last month. I actually only stayed there 18 days and then I got kicked out.
When did your addiction start?
My addiction started when I was 13.
Okay, so it took you from 13 to
32
to admit to yourself that you were an addict.
Yeah.
Okay. How did you feel about yourself when you realized that you were an addict? Did you feel less than?
No, I realized I had a problem and I needed to fix it, but I didn't know how to fix it. I didn't know the right steps to take, and they laid it out for you. Pretty much you follow these 12 steps, and by the time you finish it, you'll get a grasp of yourself and who you are. And I just chose to pick up a book and read it, and then, you know, read it again and see what I got out of it, and chose to get a sponsor and, you know, ask for guidance and then pray to the Lord, like, show me the way.
You know, do you come across, and I imagine, you know, because you're a little bit further along and then there's guys further along than you. Do you look at it and say, like, man, did it ever cross your mind where you're like, yeah, I've got it all figured out? Like,
this day, I still don't know anything. You know what I mean? It's kind of hard on my aspect. I have 9 sponsees. I have 9 people that look up to me for guidance. One of my sponsees celebrated 1 year yesterday. I have another one right now celebrating 9 months today. But they help me out more than I help them out. They remind me how bad it used to be. They remind me how fast I could lose everything. One of our main sayings in our recovery program that we are a part of, the 12-step program we are a part of, is like you were saying, that you said in your time in the class of your, it's just for today. If I wake up clean mm-hmm. and I fight all day long to stay clean and I could go to bed clean, I won today. I can't change what I did yesterday, and I'm not guaranteed tomorrow at all. Days will equal weeks, weeks will equal months, months will equal years. You know what I mean? That's when time starts accumulating like that. But if I focus on just for today, I have a better chance of winning today than I will tomorrow.
How long do you think it takes? Like, you know, I know everybody's going to be different, but at some point there's probably some average in there. How long do you think it takes where you're 71 days into it, and it's using you because you're the new guy in the group. 71 days in where you're learning these new tools, right? Yeah. Tools, sayings, affirmations, hearing this stuff. And then you get to a point where, you know, now you start practicing this in your daily applications out in the real world. Like, you're always going to probably, hopefully you maintain going to groups and stuff, but when you're tested, like you lose your job, your son, you know, runs away. How long do you think it takes before this becomes second nature to where you don't have to, where your critical thinking is now, it's become second choice. It's like secondhand nature. It's like, oh, that's, of course, that's the way I'd respond in a positive light. For me, it took a long time. Like, I'd be told these things, you know, if this happens, try to do this. But sometimes in the moment, somebody says something slick to you, looks at you wrong, you want to pop off and smack them or shoot them or run them down. And you have to challenge those thoughts and go, this is not how you live a pro-social life. You know, turning the cheek to the other side or walking away from somebody that's being aggressive or punking you out, calling you a bitch or a punk. You and I spoke about those.
Yeah.
Those are two very like disrespectful words.
And that's the reason why I got kicked out of JOTC is because a kid came in there not serious about his recovery. And I knew about it. And I was like, dude.
You weren't serious about yours either.
No, I was. And he was like.
Right. See where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
He was on some kind of time.
And he tested me, and then I was
and
like.
You failed.
Yeah, I failed big time. And that day is what changed my life, because I was like, man, this is a 28 day program, and I couldn't even stay fucking 28 days. And when I had them take me, I had them drop me off at a meeting, and I went to a meeting, and I kept going to a meeting.
So you didn't go back and use?
No, okay. I didn't. I just went straight to a meeting. And I haven't left that meeting. I've been there almost every day. I'm going to say every day, but almost every day. And I try to, like, they do this thing called 90 and 90, 90 meetings, 90 days. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get to 180 and 90.
Okay.
I'm trying to double up on, you know, get the most I can out of it.
But how important is it now? The lesson you learned there is some people are forced into treatment. Some people are in treatment for other people. I want to be there for my kid. I want to be there for my wife. But then your wife leaves you. It's like, well, why am I here? Like he said, the minute they took his kid away, he's already hitting the meth pipe. He got pissed off for that moment when he misheard the story and he thought he wasn't going to get his kid back, but he chose to go into that meeting anyway. Somebody said the wrong thing in a meeting where they weren't serious and affected you to where you got kicked out of the meeting. That's what I'm asking you is being able to apply the tools in the necessary environment, because it's not always, you're not always going to go to a meeting where everybody wants to be there. You're going to come across some clowns, but you have to be able to like chew up the meat and spit out the bones. So I think you're on a great track, man, but you got to be realistic with the world we live in where days are not going to be easy sometimes.
And they're not.
How you respond is really what separates the boys from the men.
In the meetings, like I have dealt with that, but in JOTC, we weren't allowed to leave. But in the meeting, if, you know, I feel disrespected or like in real life, like it is, and Floyd has actually taught me that, just walk away. It's better be your bigger man and walk away. Then, you know, lose something that you fought so hard to get.
That's a tough one, though, for
it
real.
Is, but it is. It
it's
is.
It's a tough really. One for all of us.
But and yeah. Floyd's actually taught me that. Like, I've seen it firsthand, and it changed my whole life. And it's like, nobody's going to think of you as less of a man.
Right.
If anything.
Probably more of a man.
More of a man than anything. And it opened my whole eyes. And it's like, it's so hard to do, though. It's so hard to do.
That's using those tools in real time. In prison, we had it's very similar to the shit you guys are going through now. It was called an RSA, rational self-analysis, where we would have what's called a camera check. You would take that entire instance of what you just explained. You're in a group. The guy said something. or I don't know if he said it directly to you, or tell me what happened when you got kicked out. Like, what was the incident, if you can?
Yeah, what happened was a guy was just like mistreating everybody, you know? And then I just like, hey, bro, stop being a little bitch in there. And he's like, what? I could end you right now. And I just started laughing at him. I'm like, bro, you could have heard a fly. And like, he kind of like chest bumped me. And then it was over after that. Like, I pushed him against the wall. And by me putting my hands on him, it's all over.
You're done.
And then like, he straight up went to the office, snitched on me. Oh, he pushed me. And I was like, dude, you're a little girl. Like, how are you going to just call me out? And then when you got like, you know what I mean? So after that, it's like when they kick you out for any reason, honestly.
Right. Well, and honestly, that's a pretty good reason.
Yeah, it is.
Right?
Put your
hands on them.
Put your hands on them.
So now in RSA, we would take that incident and we would say, okay, camera check would be what happened. The guy wasn't taking it serious. And if I asked you what your beliefs were in that moment, when he said he could end you, what were your beliefs? He was doing what to you?
He was testing me.
Testing you. Those are your beliefs, right?
Yeah.
Now, if I said challenge those beliefs, if you could look forward and redo that whole event, if I said when he said that to you, what should you have done?
Walked away.
Walked away, right? And what would the outcome have been?
I would have completed the program.
You would have been there. So when we practice these RSAs, and we had to do these in group because we all have stuff like that happens to us where we give into that moment of weakness. But if you replay those RSAs over and over your head and you practice those RSAs, all of a sudden, in real time, you catch yourself walking away and you might be mad. You might be, man, I wish I'd popped him in. But 20 minutes later, an hour later, you're sitting down with your friends, you're eating dinner, your routine didn't get disrupted. And it seems like that's a big challenge for people is when they get pulled from somewhere and go somewhere else, it's like your routine is getting yanked. Your friends that you just made, you get up at this time of day, you go hang out with this person, you eat at this time. These are hard things for people to get over. And you're still new into it. And it's good that you got a dude like this because back over to you a little bit, camera shift. back over to you, you know, your background, you were a straight up gangbanger.
Correct.
Yep. And you were affiliated to what?
I was a part of North Daniels.
So, you know, and until I moved to Washington or until I went to prison and came out of prison, I didn't even know white people could be part of, I'm assuming you're white.
Yeah.
This assumption I just made. So you're a white dude that's in North Daniel. So what was that like? Like, how did you get involved into the gang life at a young age? And talk about what you can without, you know, obviously putting business out there, but what can you talk about that kind of built the cognitions and your way of life, the way you recognize things?
So I'm that dirty ghetto kid from the east side of Yakima, government raised, food stamp using, government cheese eats, east side kid. Parents didn't really care about what I did, what I was doing, anything like that. I had no consequences, never disciplined. I come and go as I wanted. But I was raised by my grandma. I spent a lot of time at my grandma's house. I was really into sports and all that in middle school and all that. And at the age of 14, I'm down the street at a friend's house and I get a call from I call her my mom. Before I would call her my egg donor. Your grandma just passed away. And I'm like, fuck no, there's no way. Shut the fuck up, bitch, you're lying. I ran to her house and she wasn't there. I ran to the old hospital, the one that we have shut down right now, ran in, everybody was in there and they were like, she's gone. I'm like, there's no way, you know? And I snuck in through all the rooms and I finally found out where she was and I seen that she was dead. Been like an hour before the doctors caught me in there and everybody was trying to like love on me. I'm like, why are you guys loving on me now? You didn't love on me yesterday. You guys didn't care about what I did yesterday. You know what I mean? She's the only one that ever gave a shit about what I did in life. So what I did was I went down the street on the neighborhood I was raised on, East Chestnut, right down the street here. Went down to my neighborhood group of kids and I was like, court me in.
What does that mean?
Jump me into the gang. You know what I mean? Jump me in. And they're like, you've already been a part of us. You know, you're from the neighborhood. The gang that I wanted to get courted into, they said, no, we already have enough white people. I think they had like three. So I end up hanging out with another member. We called him Clown. He was in a wheelchair. Craziest dude I've ever met in my life. In a wheelchair. And he would take out 90% of people in this town. We went to a party and they were like, you know, his clique was like, hey, let's jump in Floyd. And he was like, yeah, court him in, let's get him in, you know? So there was like nine dudes. And they're like, you ready? I'm like, ready for what? And they just started socking. And I just started fighting back. I just thought they were trying to fight me. And at the end, they courted, you know, I got courted in. And I went straight back to the neighborhood I was from, East Chestnut. And we were all a group of friends, but now we're all banging North Daniels, XIV, you know what I mean? And then our different cliques that we're from. And we started hanging out, doing all that. And this was at the age of 14. I was still going to Davis. And one day, they kicked me out of Davis for some graffiti that I didn't even do. Somebody else did. But everybody snitched on me, saying it was me, because I was a graffiti head. And so they sent me to an alternative school at Southeast Community Center. This is where I got my nickname from. There was 19 students in this little... The room's still there at the Southeast Kid. There's like a little building on the outside with all these faces painted on it. 17 girls and two boys, me and my other buddy. And 15 of those girls were Norteñas, the female gang. And every day I would ask each one of those girls, hey, can I have a dollar? I was the youngest one. I think I was like 15 and a half. So they gave me a dollar every day for like 3 months. And then finally my buddy was like, we're heading to McDonald's right there on South First Street. He's like, damn, bro, you're milking the shit out of these girls. I'm like, I just asked them for a dollar. They're like, we're going to start calling you the milkman. And one of the girls caught on. They're like, we're never giving you money again. And my name just stuck. Like from there, everybody just started calling me milkman. We went out of school one day. We went to go sell a pistol to some, we call them FISAs.
Kind of not affiliated.
Yeah, they're not affiliated, you know, but they're not they're like, cool. They're cool cats. You know what I mean? They're just like straight from the border, you know? We went to sell him a 9mm. We're standing in a circle and the gun went off and it shot me in my thigh. It hit the ground, ricocheted, got me in my thigh. So I went to the hospital. The cops were like, who did it? I don't know. Blah, blah. You gave him the whole story. Came home and the dude that accidentally shot me was in my class with me. And he's like, are you okay, bro? I feel so bad, this and that. And I'm like, yeah, it's cool. You know, I'm good. Don't worry. It was like an inch from my main artery. I could have, you know, died. 2 weeks later, I'm down here at the 7-Eleven down the street, and I get shot again, this time with a 12-gauge shotgun. Two minivan rolls up on us. My two friends take off. They shoot at him. They miss him. I was so coked out at the age of 15 and a half that I thought I was running like the mile like in 30 seconds, but I guess I was walking. And they got me. They got me in the back of my legs. So, you know, I got shot twice in like in 3-4 weeks or something.
And this was... rival gang?
Yeah. The second time was a rival gang.
So you didn't do anything specific other than you were just on the wrong side of the fucking fence, basically.
No, they came into our territory.
No, I mean wrong side of the fence, meaning you just were opposite gang.
Yeah, I was wearing the wrong color.
Okay.
You know, I was wearing my color and they were rivals and they were out searching for something to do. So, you know, I did all that, you know, and basically...
How many times have you been shot?
I've been those two times.
Okay.
Those two times. Never been stabbed. Never been ran over. I just been shot. And back in the 90s, there was nothing in this town for youth to do. And I'll say that again. Yakima City Council had nothing for us to do. They shut down all the programs, our after-school programs. We didn't have the skate parks. We didn't have nothing. So all we can do is just hang out with each other. So that's what we did. But at the same time, I was searching for a family. And what I found in game banging was a family. People that gave me attention, that praised the stuff that I did. Remember, I said I was a graffiti artist. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of graffiti. And they would be like, oh, bro, you see what Milkman did last night? He did a big old piece on the back of Gary's Red Apple, which is now where the Holiday Inn is on Yakima Ave. You know, they would praise me for it. And I was like, my parents never did that. All the sports I played, they never came to watch me play. So I was like, I was enjoying it.
Were your parents substance abuse users?
No, nobody in my family's ever does substance, but they were, play bingo a lot. That was my mom's addiction, was gambling. So, you know, I did that for a long time of my life, a long time. I left here in 99. Moved to Portland, Oregon with, I call him homie. A homie from here, he moved away before I did. He's like, come over here, you can get your life situated. So I went over there and my best friend at that time, a week later, shoot somebody in the head at the Southeast Community Center. So he comes over to where I'm at and like a month later, G-Unit and all that swarmed up on the place. But it took me a week to get it out of him. Like, why'd you come here for? He's like, hey, bro, I shot somebody. You know, I need to get out of here. I'm like, I'm going to ride with you, bro. Whatever you need to do, we'll do together. So when the cops rolled up on us, we went to the mall. And when we came back, we seen they surrounded our apartment that we were living in. We took off. The cops followed us, pulled us over. And they're like, hey, what the fuck's your name? What the? And I'm like, my name's Floyd. They're like, what the fuck's your name? And I didn't know what G-Unit was because we never had that back here in Yakima.
Gang unit?
Yeah, we didn't have no gang unit. We had just Cortez, Gonzalez, you know, the two officers that dealt with the ghetto of Yakima. And I'm like, they call me Milkman. You're under arrest for murder. All right, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, it is what it is. Let's go. So I pulled up behind him and he looks at me. He's like, hey, I'm sorry. I'm like, hey, bro, we're riding together no matter what. You know what I mean? 6.5 hours later, they let me out of cop car. And they were asking me like, hey, you want to have lunch so I could figure out how gangs are? Because in Vancouver, Washington, there really wasn't gang banging back over there. And I'm like, no. I started living a normal life over there. I got a job. I became a general manager at Jiffy Lube over there, you know, and they picked me because I was from the hood. You know what I mean? I lived that street life. They knew I knew how to hustle. Got married and all that. When my ex-wife left me, I came back to Yakima. I came back to the same group of friends I left in 99. The only thing that's changed is now, instead of being juveniles, kicking it at house parties, we are now kicking at bars. I came back and I was right back into it. You know what I mean? Came in, you're wearing the opposite color, or I remember you from back then, and I'll be hitting you up in the bar doing whatever I had to do. There's been multiple bar fights, Jackson's, La Creta, El Faro, all of those. Did that for a while. And I remember I went to the Caribbean one night and some of them girls that were in that school with me, they were there. And they're like, hey, Milkman, long time no see, this and that. I'm like, hey, there's this chick you guys have in your hood. I'm going to get her. And they're like, bro, you have no chance of getting her, blah, blah, blah. Well, fast forward a little bit. She's my baby's mama now. You know what I mean? She's my better half. And I say better half because I did a lot of shit to her when I was in their active addiction. So we're working through the stuff that we did.
Can you talk about that at all? Or
Yeah.
Talking like physical, mental?
Physically, mentally, verbally abusive. You know what I mean? Like, she should not be around me right now. You know what I mean? But we're working through that. Every day I have to make amends to her. I have always worshipped the ground she walked on, except when I was out there actively using. But the whole time I was game banging, you know, I went from marijuana to cocaine, to crank, which is before meth even came around. That was like old biker crank of meth. I've done acid, all these drugs before I turned 18. It was a normal thing. Like, that's just what you did. Drink, do all that, blah, blah, blah. When I moved over to Portland, that's when weed became a big part. That's when chronic came around. Because in Yakima, we had dirt weed back then, brick weed, gasoline, cat piss weed, you know. Over there, that's when chronic hit. And I started doing all that. I came back to Yakima, and I remember I went to the first bar, and I walked in the bathroom, and some of those spices that I was talking about earlier I sold gun to, they were in there, and they were talking Spanish, you know. And I'm white, you know what I mean? But I was raised with Hispanics all my life, so they look at me like, no matter if you're white, you're still brown on the inside. And I hear them in there like, hey, wait, un pedicaso, pedicaso. And I'm like, hey, wait, bust out. And they're like, okay. You know, talking to me in Spanish. And then they started giving to me. And I come out and I'm like, it started all over again. Like, it just gave me flashbacks. Like, all right, now you could drink a lot more. But then my anger just got worse, you know. So did the whole bar scene for like 3 years. Never got a DUI. Don't know how that happened.
You told me you're not even a felon, correct?
Correct. I have no felonies in mind. I don't even know what the inside of county jail looks like.
It blows my mind. Like, I somehow made it to federal prison.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
Congratulations, man. It's really wild because you're every bit of a past felon without the record.
Correct.
You can own a gun right now.
No, I have
a DV.
I have a DV.
Yeah.
But like in a couple years I can, you know what I mean? Yeah, no, I should have been in the prison system, you know, for all the stuff I've done. But for some weird reason, I just never got caught. You know what I mean? Or I never got involved into something where I was going to get caught.
But what is it like now when you go out and see, do you see rival gang members that obviously you're living a different life, but if they're still in that life and they see you?
So I started at age of 14 because my grandma passed away. I'm 43 now. I'll be 44 this year. I stepped away a long time ago because I was already old enough. You know, there's a whole new generation of them out. Mm-hmm. But I still kicked it with my set of people that I grew up with. You know, you could call us OGs or whatever, however you want to look at it. But when I came into recovery, I had to do one major thing. I had to change the people I used to hang out with. And that was probably one of the hardest things for me and my significant other to do.
Because really, like, that's who you had stuff in common with.
That's my family. You know what I mean? These are the people that I grew up with. But when I was acting in active addiction, they didn't give a shit about me because I wasn't doing nothing for them. Mm-hmm. I was a tweaker. You know what I mean? They badmouthed me. They did all that. And when I noticed that, then I'm like, well, screw them too, you know? But there was a couple that, you know, still loved on me, but just from far away. So when I came into recovery, I heard that you have to change your playmates, play teams, and playgrounds. So which means I can't hang out with the same people. I can't go back to my neighborhood and hang out. And I can't continue doing the same things. There's another saying, if you continue kicking it at a barbershop, you're going to end up getting a haircut. You know what I mean?
I like that. I'm stealing that. I'm stealing that, Floyd.
Yeah. No, go ahead. Take it all day long. So I just jumped straight into recovery. You know what I mean? Like I had to break the cycle somewhere. And I'm the one that's going to break the cycle for my son. You know what I mean? Because when I first had him, I was happy. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to get him some Cortezes. He's going to have some little Dickies on with the red belt hanging. You know, he doesn't have to get courted in because his mom...
Future little gang member.
Yeah, his mom and dad are both affiliated. You know what I mean? Like, he's born into this.
Making it sound like he's born into, like, being a Hollywood star.
Yeah,
it's the same, but a gang member.
Basic same thing, but just a gang banger.
What do you hear now when, what does it sound like to you now?
Like, I'm forcing him to be something that he doesn't want to be.
Or like a death warrant. Like,
yeah.
Like
you know what I mean?
Put this kid into danger.
Yeah, right? Exactly. You know what I mean? So when I came into recovery, I had to change all that. So I just stepped away. There were some of my friends that I would tell, like, hey, bro, I'm in recovery now. And they're like, okay, you know, they're like, that's good. There's some people that look at me like, you're a fucking dropout, you're a sellout, whatever. It is what it is, bro. You continue doing what you want to do. You know what I mean? I know multiple people that are doing life behind walls or a lot of time beyond walls because of
the
beliefs that we had. And then when they finally came to their senses, they're like, I don't want to do this no more. Now they're green lighted, which means now they have to go PC up. They're in protective custody, mm-hmm. but they're still doing the time mm-hmm. for the beliefs that they were believing in at that time.
And they're doing even harder time in a way because they can't walk normal yards. They can't sit at regular tables. In prison, it's like when you have people that cooperate or snitch or drop out of gangs, you end up doing maybe a little bit less time, but almost harder time because your days are really, you have nothing to do.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And I mean, I don't know. I've never been to prison, but it's the same thing like on the streets. You know, you got your everyday living. Now you have to change that.
Can't go to the same 7-Eleven.
Yeah. You know, so it took some time. And now that I'm into where I'm at, so like, let me fall back a little bit. So my baby's mama, my better half, she went to her hood and was like, court me out.
I was going to ask, how do you officially get out?
She got courted out.
You get beat up going
out. They beat her out. You know what I mean? But in reality, she beat them up. And everybody knew that was going to happen. With me, I walked away. And it's probably because the people I grew up with were already old enough. You know what I mean?
A lot of them probably did the same.
Yeah.
They're dead or in prison.
They're doing family stuff now. You know what I mean? Right. Like, they're doing family stuff. Like, they have families or they're in prison or they're dead. So it was, that's how it happened. But now that I'm in recovery, and I'm becoming a better person, I'm being a normal person in society nowadays, those people that I used to hang out with, they're coming to me like, hey, man, my son's doing fentanyl. How do I help him? And I'm like, do you have a minute to talk? And I'll explain to you what you have to do. And, you know, his son is like a nephew of mine. You know what I mean? My brothers are on that cheese right now. I bet you right now, if we go down that cheese, he's standing right there on the on that cheese high. You know what I mean? So it is tough, but it's, I'm here so they can see that you can change. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That there is a better life. Other from addiction, game banging, just street life itself. Going back on Phil with him, getting punked at the treatment facility, because that's what we would call it. You got punked. You know what I mean? He was living in false pride. When I came into this 12-step program, my first meeting, I walked around. I went in the meeting. I looked at every man. I was like, who am I going to jump? Who am I going to take out? Just like if you went to the penitentiary, who's the biggest, baddest person here? That's one I want. You know what I mean? Because of my false pride. Because of the pride I was taught out there, which is totally wrong. You know, coming into this thing.
I just realized your hat says Dopeless. I thought I said Dodgers. Just
oh, no, no, no. I'm a Dopeless all-star.
That's cool.
You know, and I like, and like that too with the whole game banging. So I wore red all my life. Nobody's ever seen me with the color blue on. Never. My sponsor is from the street life also. He's from the penitentiary. He's from a different side that I would not even talk to if I ever did go to the pen. And I remember I went to a meeting that he was out, and I came in with some blue flats on, some Adidas flats, you know, slippers. And he's like, are you fucking okay? I'm like, what? He's like, you got blue on, bro. I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I put like this dark blue shirt on one day. You know, it doesn't matter to me no more. You know what I mean? I'm able to do that now, you know? And I'm like, he's like, now you're wearing a blue shirt. Like, dude, are you sure you're okay? Because, man, this is not you. You know what I mean? This took you a year to do this. You know, I get to test different stuff out. And I get to live life. I get to wear what I want, do what I want, hang out with who I want. Like we were talking about last time I was here. So in like 95, we used to have the Yakima Mall right here. It was off and cracking. For anybody that lived in Yakima, that place was cracking. There used to be a store in there called Sam Goody's, which, you know, used to be back when you used to buy CDs and cassettes, because nowadays everybody's downstreaming everything.
Yeah.
I miss the good old days. Me and my buddy, the one that shot that dude in the head, we're walking through the mall and we go into Sam Goody's and we're picking out Ice Cube. Today was a good day. We're going to jack it. And I turn around and there's like four rivals standing at the entrance and they're just looking at us. They're like, we caught you motherfuckers. You know what I mean? Like, we got you guys slipping now. And I'm like, fuck, dude, we have nothing on us. We have no weapons. You know what I mean? We just got out of school. So we just mobbed in the mall to mob out really quick. And one of the dudes, he opened up his coat and this motherfucker had a MAC-10 on him. And I'm like, okay, you know what I mean? We threw a couple blows and we darted out. We ran. You know what I mean? This is how funny life is. Years later, I think I was 16 at this time. I'm 42 now, or now I'm 43, but yeah, it was when I was 43. I'm at my home group meeting and there's a newcomer and I'm looking at him like, I know this guy from somewhere. I just can't picture it in my head. And everybody, there's always a saying like, hey, anybody willing to sponsor? And at that time I would raise my hand. He came to me after a meeting and he's like, hey, will you be my sponsor? And I'm like, well, this is the requirements I require you to do. Are you willing to do them? Yeah, I'll do whatever it takes. All right. And like 2 weeks later, I'm sitting there like, where do I know this guy from? So I was like, hey, bro, come here really quick. Let me talk to you. That was after one of the requirements where I actually took him on as a sponsee. I'm like, hey, bro, where do I know you from? He's like, I'm so-and-so from West Side Hustler. I'm like, I knew it. He's like, I'm the one that put the MAC-10 on you at the mall. That's how much we've changed. I've changed. You know what I mean? I am now, and me and him are very good friends now. You know what I mean? I call him, he calls me.
Isn't that funny?
That's what I'm saying. This is how funny
Francis,
it is.
Francis, that 100%, we're going to turn that into a short, that whole little segment right there.
You know, that's where it would have never happened if I was out on the streets. You know what I mean? If I was still doing all that, I wouldn't even think about talking. One of my sponsee brothers, he's a rival from back in the days. And me and him are really close. I call them for a lot of stuff because like they understand my way of thought. Like something just came up personally in my personal life with my kids. My number one thought is go kill them. And I call him. I'm like, what should I do? He's like, call your sponsor. I call my sponsor and my sponsor is like, yeah, we could go kill them right now. but what's that going to do for your kids? Where are you going to be at tomorrow? We have to be here for the kids now. We have to find a different way. He had a situation came up about his kid, you know, and I'm like, you have to realize you've never been a father to her. And that's really hard to hear. You know what I mean? I'm like, where have you been all your life? In and out of prison, on the streets. I'm like, you never been a father to her. So how are you going to start acting like a father to her? You know, you have to start somewhere. And that's just, don't start off like you're the father. Like, she's not going to ever believe you that way. And I had to learn that, you know what I mean? So he helps me, I help him. But the best thing is that when I'm in a meeting, I search for those game bangers. When I go to treatment facilities, I go to a lot of treatment facilities, a lot, to go speak Spirit Straight That Hope to the next suffering addict. I look for the game bangers. I don't look for the white folks, the black folks, the Mexicans. I look for a certain group of people that's out there using.
Because you can relate to them.
Because I could relate to them and I could show them like, hey, that way of life is not the right way. Come over here. I did it. I'm proof. I'm living proof that this 12-step program works if you work it to the best of your ability. But don't get it twisted. I'm one hit away from losing everything. Let me re-say that one more time. One hit away from losing everything that I've had in this little bit over 27 months. You know what I mean? One bad decision, I could lose everything.
With Yakima Recovery Events, you guys do a lot of like barbecues, Easter egg hunts, kid stuff. What do you got coming up right now that the community should look forward to?
Our next event is March 30th, the day before Easter, and it's called the Spring Event. It's for anybody in Yakima. You don't have to be in recovery to show up. This is a spring event for the children, the families out there, less fortunate. Just come out, Queens Gym, 52nd and Chestnut. It's from 2 to 4. Go to Yakima Recovery Events on Facebook. And let me say this. Earlier in this segment, you were talking about maybe somebody should start a website to introduce all this stuff. Let's just keep it real. When you're in active addiction, I'm not checking the internet for anything. I'm calling my sponsor. I'm calling a dealer to get high. That's what Yakima Recovery Events is. We just became a nonprofit organization, and we try to take the message from both 12-step programs that we're involved in out to the streets. So this year, we want to really get into heading over to Natchez down North First Street, feeding them, giving them awareness of where they can go, what if they want help, if they need help, giving them the guidance of what to do. Throwing on more events, doing a lot of stuff for the community. They let them see that we're still having fun in recovery, even though we're not using no more.
Guys, Dan Wise, Wise Media Studios. This was not your typical interview, but these are the kind of interviews that I think we need more of, not just in Yakima, but in our nation. So I don't know why I'm going to cry. Real men cry. Later, guys.
Later.